Vladimir Putin said that he was going to support Kamala Harris with a big wry smile on his face, and the news people who reported it started to fall off of their chair laughing. So there's a lot of trolling going on the internet and elsewhere. So I wouldn't blame Elon for this. This is just a bunch of people with a very strange sense of humor and way too much free time.
Okay, so what about quantum navigation?
Okay, that shouldn't take more than about 5 or 6 hours, but I'll try and shorten it a great deal. The concept, and I put up the video on my link page, so again, just type in roy.ac2gs.com, that'll bring you to the link page, and it's up there. Anyway, quantum guidance. The concept is that present GPS can be jammed. So it's very accurate. It's a great technology, but it's an external technology that is capable of being jammed. So the idea is, how do you build some guidance system that cannot be jammed? Well, you could use dead reckoning. The problem with dead reckoning is that the speeds that airplanes manage, you're going to very quickly, the errors are too high. So after a very short trip, you won't be able to have the faintest idea where you are by using accelerometers because they're just not accurate. So you have to then design acceleration devices that are very, very accurate. So a group of researchers, I think it was in Oxford, are working on a quantum a guidance system that is basically so uses some real esoteric stuff. There's something called Bose-Einstein condensates. What happens is electrons and protons and neutrons are all called fermions. Fermions have half spins. Half spin particles cannot exist in the same place at the same time. But if you put them into atoms and you cancel out all their spins and then you lower their temperature to very close to absolute zero, they become a condensate, which acts as a boson, which can exist in the same space. And so what you've effectively done is you've created something that acts like a very, very, very large atom, complete with quantum mechanical qualities, but it's a macroscopic object. You are then able to actually produce matter waves off of it. Since it's a quantum mechanical object, it has wave-particle duality. So not only does it behave as a particle, it behaves as a wave. If it behaves as a wave, you could use it in an interferometer, you know, the thing that we use for gravitational waves and such. So using it as a wave source for an interferometer, you can get a very accurate assessment of the acceleration of your plane. So using that information, you can use dead reckoning instead of GPS. So that's the fundamental concept. You're basically using particles as waves because as Bose-Einstein condensates, they behave as a single atom with all the weirdness that quantum mechanics gives single atoms, whereas if you take a whole bunch of atoms and put them together, they don't act as a quantum mechanical object. They kind of start to work like they do in the world that we see them, as Newton saw them. But if you keep them at that very low temperature, which is done by an interesting technology, let me drop and I'll tell you how they brought the temperature down. They use something called Doppler laser technology. Well, what effectively they do is they tune the laser so that it's only going to be absorbed by atoms which are racing towards it at a certain velocity. If they're standing still, the Doppler effect doesn't affect it. If they're traveling away from the laser, the Doppler effect undermines it. It changes the frequency in the opposite direction. But if it's going towards the laser just right, the Doppler effect changes the frequency to one where the photon is absorbed by the atom, which then the momentum forces it in the opposite direction. So effectively, you put a bunch of these Doppler lasers in six axes, you are able to slow down their motion in those axes. And as we all know, temperature is the average kinetic energy of something. So if you slow something's movement down, you lower its temperature. So that's how they were able to bring the temperature close to zero and have it form a Bose-Einstein condensate, which was then able to act at producing matter waves, which could generate interference patterns according to the acceleration of this object. And so you have excellent dead reckoning because you have high precision accelerometer results. So that's it in a nutshell. There's a lot more.
So we don't have too much time. I have just two subjects for poll, so it would be like a question at his panel. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy, for the explanation. Aster H2 2024 PT5 is going close to the Earth right now. And wow, is it gonna hit the Earth? Are we gonna have the same what we had? There was the live extinction five times in the Earth, and the last one was with the asteroid. So a few words about that from Paul, if he could.
Yeah, but that was going to pass like over 300,000 miles away from Earth. That's further than the moon. So, you know, that's no concern. I think that type of thing happens all the time. They might not all be as big as that one. You know, what was it, 35 feet or something in diameter. So I'm not too worried about that one. These things come up a lot, you know. There is one called the Apophis. That one's going to come by in, I think, 2027 or so. And there's going to be spacecraft that are actually going to fly out and look at that one. But, you know, I remember when they first found that, oh, that's going to hit the Earth, you know. And meanwhile, a few times the distance away from the moon. That's pretty far. Anyway, back to you.
Thank you very much for that. It is 11 meters, which is 36 feet in diameter. And it was discovered by ATLAS, South Africa, Switzerland, on August 7, 2024, the day before approaching Earth. So it is coming close. It is going to the orbit of the sun. It is a solar body that makes slow, close approaches to the Earth-Moon system. So between this September 29 of 2024 and November 25th, 2024, is going to be very close to the Earth. But I have another question for you. And that is about the return astronaut on the private flight. The achievement of SpaceX from today sounds to me like some sort of visual form of ultimatum. So Elon Musk would say, I have our spacecraft that flies higher than you never did before. I have a space suit of my own. I don't need professional astronauts because I could have my engineers. So I have my own engineers. I can send them to keep Hubble alive. And I have a complex solution in my hands. I don't need you, but actually what I need you to pay me money, it makes you spend less. So I'm Elon Musk. I can do it without you. You cannot do it without me because you don't have the money for it. Too much of bureaucracy out there. So, that may sound like rhetoric of Mr. Trump. Of course, I'm joking. So the question is, is anything of that real at some point? Paul?
I read that. As far as I'm concerned, he's either in another world, or whoever wrote that is in another world, you know. I mean, basically, they're saying this guy now wants to be a dictator and control everything on Earth, including what's up in space as well. So, I would just skip past that page, you know. You know, when you have 11,000 people working for you just for SpaceX, you know, I'm not talking about his all the other businesses he's got going. I believe those people are coming up with ideas on a regular basis. They're, you know, engineers and, you know, people that are coming up with this stuff. And it's just not one person. And if it was, you know, investors would be a little worried because you don't want that. Something happens to the one they call the main man, for the main man insurance, they call it. You know, you take out insurance because just in case something happens to that guy, you know, your whole company would go down the tubes. That can't be the case. There's a lot of people giving him information, you know, and he brings it to, you know, he puts it on his Twitter or whatever it is. So, I don't know. If I was reading it, I would just skip the page. But you sent it to me, Wesley, because you did that. I wound up reading through it. And, you know, I'm really not impressed by that. You don't do everything by yourself. You need a group of people to accomplish anything. Back to you.
What is your take on it, Dr. Roy?
Well, I mean, thanks for the opportunity to let me balance the scales. Having said actually good things about Elon, he's a pathological narcissist. He's a sociopath. I wouldn't believe that the sun was in the sky over Texas at 12 noon just because he said it. I would have to have some other proof by a third party. I think, unfortunately, we're stuck with him for the time being. We've somehow subsidized him through a lot of stuff and given him the opportunity to be an incredible security risk. But eventually, this too will change, and there'll come a time, hopefully, that we will not hear his name. I look forward to those days.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't have any more stuff. Thank you for the time giving me to talk about it. And back to Dr. Roy and to Asia.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everyone who participated. You know, I mean, you know, take my disregard for Elon with a grain of salt, if you're so inclined, if you're part of the movement. Then keep believing on a star, and who knows, maybe 20 years there's going to be a city in Mars. I'd like to take everyone's bet on that personally, but there's only so much time and so much money and so many people who are willing to bet foolish things. Anyway, always a pleasure, but it is 10:16 in some seconds, so we will move on to the SpaceNet report. Again, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had an enjoyable experience. You learned a few things. We'll see. So on with the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2M.
Okay, Roy, yeah, we could do that. And I was going to start off with a SpaceX topic. The Polaris mission, Polaris Dawn, successfully got back. Which I'm glad to hear. And, yeah, talk about rolling the dice. You know, this whole mission was, you know, I'm glad it all worked out. But the idea of sending four people into space, not going to the International Space Station, is the first gamble. You know, when we lost Columbia in February 2003, that space shuttle, we lost 7 people on board. You know, after that, NASA made the decision, that's it. No other space shuttles are going up unless they dock with the International Space Station. Now, you know, why did I say that? Because the Columbia mission, when that went up, had no intention of going to the space station. That was just a science mission. The space station was there, but they were just sending it on a regular science mission. Yeah, heavy, heavy science mission for those 7 astronauts. But, you know, in fact, the Columbia, it was not even designed to go to the International Space Station anymore. It was actually too heavy. The other space shuttles were. So that went on a, you know, regular journey around the Earth. But then, you know, when they thought they might have a problem with what, you know, a piece of the foam hitting the wing, you know, and they tried to get telescopes to look at it, and they were thinking about getting military's telescopes to look at it, but they scratched that idea because the military didn't want other countries to know, you know, how sophisticated their stuff was, that we would be able to do that. So without that information, you know, eventually, February 3rd, they come flying through the atmosphere and want ended up burning up because nobody knew that there was a hole in that wing. So NASA made this decision, no more space shuttle missions unless they're going to the International Space Station, because if you were there, they could do fly arounds, which they started to do after that. They would, a shuttle would come up and it would do pirouettes and everything right in front of the space station. They would take extremely close photographs of every square inch of that thing, and you know, they would dock and then eventually undock and fly back to Earth. That was the rule after that, and they only made one exception, and that was the last Hubble service mission. There was a lot of people that were called Hubble huggers, including Dick K2RAW. He was one of them. And they all pushed to make sure that Hubble got, you know, sent back to a higher orbit for another 14 or miles, or at least higher than where it is. So less of a chance of it hitting rarefied atmosphere and eventually starting to deorbit. So, you know, 2009, they sent the final mission up, and they even made a special safety thing involved with that particular mission. What they did is they put the other shuttle Enterprise on one of the other launch complexes. You know, you have launch complex 39A and 39B. Roughly half of them, you know, half of the shuttle flights were flown from either A or B. So what they said, well, okay, we'll send the Hubble mission up, they call it STS-125, to the to Hubble and work on it and do what we got to do for about a week. But in case something goes wrong, we're going to have this other space shuttle ready to fly to rescue the astronauts if need be. Well, we didn't need to do it. But, I mean, these were billion-dollar safety rules that was, you know, that they started to put in place. Elon Musk comes along and says, well, we don't worry about that type of thing. We're going to send this mission not to the space station, but a high elliptical orbit, 800 miles apogee, 140 miles perigee. And on top of that, we're also going to do a spacewalk. So, you know, he's rolling the dice, hoping that nothing goes wrong. And fortunately, you know, actually, this whole mission had nothing to do with NASA. There wasn't $1 of NASA money being poured into this. All private money. And money was actually being funded by Jared Isaacman. He was the commander on this mission. And he's a billionaire. And he him and the other three people. It was four people on that flight. Highly elliptical orbit, and on top of everything, they're going in through the Van Allen belts. Van Allen belts are you know, very high, a couple hundred, about 400 miles up at least at one point. And there's also another band of belts much higher in orbit. But anyway, they're flying through this radiation belt, you know, orbit after orbit. You know, it was a five-day mission. You know, now, fine. It could be dangerous for humans, but the idea is not to stay there anytime, you know, for a long period of time. When the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, they were, you know, in that belt for, you know, minutes, not days, minutes, you know, as they would accelerate, you know, going to the moon and also coming back, just a matter of minutes. That's one thing for your health, to be worried about radiation. But also, the radiation could affect the electronics on board, you know, a spacecraft. You know, these particles, let's call them particles, the radiation can get into these chips. You know, it could affect your electronics. Next thing you know, hey, well, why do I got to boot up this computer or something? And you don't want that to happen when, you know, you're in a spacecraft and you're getting ready to go home and something goes wrong because of the Van Allen belts. So that was another problem I had with that. And the other big problem was the spacewalk itself. NASA, with all the years that they've done this, has never put more than three people into an EVA. They did this one time on a space shuttle because they needed to grab hold of this spacecraft that they were trying to dock to the space station, to the space shuttle. And they actually needed three people out there to do that. That's it. I mean, that's the most. It's always two, you know, except for the earliest flight when Gemini used to go up, and they had a couple of, single flyers. And when they did that with the single flyers, the commander would, and the pilot would both be actually doing an AVA. One guy would go out, and the other guy would stay on board the Gemini. Both of them had to depressurize. There was no airlock. Now, you're looking at, what, 1964 for Ed White to do an EVA and a couple more EVAs after that. But, you know, basically, you know, the 60s. Now, here we are, you know, what, 50 years later. And with this mission, they get not only are they going to have two people officially doing an EVA, you know, in pressurized suits because they don't have an airlock. They didn't have an airlock on this thing either. No airlock on Dragon. So all four people are essentially doing an EVA. Now, suppose something had gone wrong. By the way, they brought up extra oxygen tanks, loaded them onto the Dragon, because they're going to be feeding four people pure oxygen at around 4.5 pounds per square inch. By the way, NASA has gotten it down to around 3.5 pounds. The lowest pressure you can get, the better it is for the astronaut, because when you inflate a spacesuit, it's like a football. You know, you put your hand inside of a football, and your hand was in there, it'd be very hard to maneuver. Although football, I think, has around 7 to 10 pounds of pressure. But, you know, it's very dangerous to have four people hooked up to these hoses. If something goes wrong, there's not like the other. If just two people were going to do an EVA, the other two would be on the other side of the airlock, and if something happened, they might be able to do something or work with them to get them back in. And if worse came to worst, I mean, at least you'd have two people come back to Earth and not zero. So I wasn't crazy about that idea. The other problem is they have these hoses connected to them, you know, similar to what Ed White would use for the first EVA for the United States, you know, hose, umbilical cord attached to the spacesuit, you know, to supply them air and water, you know, cooling water. NASA spacesuits, the design on that is essentially it's a spaceship in one. You know, they go outside. There's no umbilical cord attached to these people. They're getting their electricity. They're getting their oxygen, their water, and whatever they need. The carbon dioxide. They have scrubbers inside the backpack. Whatever they need is all self-contained. The only thing that is connected to the spacecraft or the space station is a tether. This tether is, you know, designed for that. But the spacesuit itself is completely self-contained, completely different than what SpaceX has. The other thing, you know, of course, if the umbilical did break, they'd be toast anyway. But, you know, let's say they designed it where they had a little backup system of oxygen in case something happened. There was no, they call it SAFER system. SAFER is an acronym for what NASA has on their spacesuits. Essentially, it's a manned maneuvering unit, a portable one that's attached to the backpack. So imagine, you know, it's two astronauts doing a spacewalk on station, and one of them breaks loose and starts floating away. They have nitrogen jets, and they could operate it, you know, from their gloves, and they'd be able to turn around and fly back to the space station if need be. Polaris Dawn, none of that. I mean, they are so far from designing a proper spacesuit. What they had worked, you know, it showed their seals worked, their helmet worked, and all. But they got a long, long way to go before they catch up to NASA. And the news media made it look like, oh, look, they're doing it. It only took them 2 years to do this. You know. Well, anyway, any comments? I know, rather long, but I was not too happy about the Polaris Dawn mission. I'm glad they landed successfully in the Gulf. They landed in the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm glad they got back okay. But still, I hope they don't do any more things like this in the future. Any comments?
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Or this is Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie. I know, I went on and on, but I was really worried about this mission. I am so glad they're back. Back to you.
This SpaceX Polaris Dawn, mission successful. My opinion is this guy, billionaire Jarek Isaacman, he's got too much money. If he can go up to space for 5 days and spend, I can't even calculate what he spends. This man's got too much money.
Yeah, when NASA sends a crew up on SpaceX, I think the estimate now is anywhere between $50 and $80 million each. You know, for the trip up and the trip back. They didn't reveal the cost of this mission of what this guy paid. And then he's taking another guy with him and two women. he did one spacewalk, came back in, and then Gillis did the second spacewalk. And when they did a spacewalk, by the way, they opened a hatch, and they had these handrails. So they stood up, and that's it. Their feet, officially, from what I see, did not leave the spacecraft. I was glad to see that. No reason to do an Ed White type of flight where you're floating around, just, you know, hanging on to your, hanging on by your umbilical cord, you know, your oxygen feed and air and leave. You don't need to do that anymore. I was glad to see they didn't do that. And so, I don't get the purpose of it, you know, outside of, they could duplicate this on Earth, you know, they have these large chambers, like, over in the, they call it the Neil Armstrong facility in Ohio now, you know, like this 50-foot diameter room. You could put astronauts in there with spacesuits on, and you could test the ability to move around the seals and make sure everything doesn't leak and all. Right here on Earth, the only difference is, you know, they got the zero-G thing going on. All right, you want to do that? Take the exact same setup, put it into one of those vomit comets, you know, the 135, the cargo planes that go, you know, they do these parabolic arcs, and you get 30 seconds of loss of gravity, you know, and they do it over and over, you know, for an hour, you know, and they might do, you know, 10 or 12 of these arcs. And you could set that up inside the airplane and pretty much do something like that. So I didn't get it, why they needed to do this outside of, reminds me of, you know, the old days, you know, when airplanes started flying, and, you know, you'd get on a wing, you know, wing walkers, you know, just, you know. That's what this reminds me of, you know, one elaborate stunt, but plenty of money. I agree, absolutely. Let me drop it. The other woman that was up there, she was like some kind of medical experience, so she was. They considered her the medical officer. I still haven't figured out what qualification she had. You know, they didn't say doctor, so I'm not sure what she had. And that's it. The one that did the EVA, she works directly from, Sarah Gillis works directly for SpaceX. She trains the astronauts. All these astronauts that go up in SpaceX Dragons need to be familiarized with all the equipment and everything. That's her job. So she wound up becoming one of the people on this flight. Anyway, Charlie, back to you. WSLS.
Maybe they're trying to get a business going, you know. Hey, let's go into space, because eventually you got to sell space travel to the public. And this, I think, is a good marketing thing.
I agree. Yeah, I didn't think of that. It could be just what you said, you know. You look how safe this is, you know. And we're going to go up to, well, they actually, SpaceX is building a small, very small space station that you could stay up there for, you know, a week or so. Two people. They are doing that. And that's actually being built by a guy that was developing a rocket. They're called the Launcher, and he was developing it in Brooklyn, and then he would test it out in Galveston, out, you know, past me, in Brookhaven Lab, not Brookhaven Lab, in Brookhaven, the old Grumman site. He was testing these little engines out there, and this guy, Holt, that's his name, he comes out of the Netherlands, and somehow he's building this little, small space station that, you know, will stay up there, and then what SpaceX wants to do is, you know, it's kind of tight. You know, you put three or four people in that Dragon, it's tight quarters, so he'll dock with this small space station, and then he'll, you know, triple the amount of room. So it's not that big, but, you know, maybe three times the size of Dragon. You know, at least that would be something, you know, if something went wrong, you know. Something, you know, it's not the International Space Station, but, you know, something is better than nothing. You know, he could have waited for that. What was the rush to do this? So he could use it on Starship, this other thing he's building? You know, he's years away from, many years away from putting a crew on that thing. Charlie, back to you.
Yeah, on the space station, it's going to the moon. Is the room service come with it?
Absolutely. I got my orders in, you know. I'm into steak and all. that's the one going to the moon. That's called Gateway. There's a lot of space stations, you know, being developed. This one by Elon Musk, it's called Haven, and that'll be in Earth orbit. But the one that NASA's putting up is called Gateway, and that will be, you could man that one for a couple of months if you wanted to, with a small crew. And that's going to be great. They've got modules being built as we speak. First two plan to be put up, I think, within a year or two. So, you know, that's NASA time, not Elon Musk time. If it was Elon Musk time, I'd say 5 years. So I give it a couple of years, and we'll start to see the beginning of the first couple of modules. They call it there's two modules. One's called the Habitat module. Of course, that's where people will stay and live and sleep. And then there's another module attached to it called the PPE, which is the Power Propulsion Element. Think of PPE, I think of COVID. No, it's nothing to do with COVID, but it's the Power Propulsion Element, and that will be attached to the Habitat module. That's going to be launched on a SpaceX vehicle. It's going to be launched on a Falcon Heavy. You know, that's three Falcons bolted together. And that's how they plan on getting that to the moon. It's so big and heavy. And SpaceX rocket is, you know, almost on a little over 4 million pounds of thrust. Still not good enough to, like, send this thing directly to the moon. So what they're going to do is it's going to orbit Earth, and orbit Earth for not months, but up to a year. And each time it goes around, it's got these ion thrusters, all ion thrusters that are going to ignite every time it gets down to perigee. And, you know, it'll keep igniting, and eventually that orbit will increase, and it'll take roughly almost a year, they said, to actually get into orbit around the moon. So what they keep doing is they extend that orbit, you know, starts off circular, and you wind up highly elliptical, you know, very close to Earth, a couple of 100 miles, but then, you know, eventually 10,000 miles away, 20 and 30, 40,000 miles away, until you get to the point where you get the equilibrium point, what do they call it, the bariatric center, you know, where it balances out, and then, you know, you're essentially going over the hill, and then the next thing after that, the moon starts becoming more of a pull on gravity than Earth, and next thing you know, you're eventually getting into lunar orbit. From there, your ion engines will start to, you should, you know, slow it down a little bit over the next couple of months until you eventually wind up with an extremely high elliptical orbit, polar orbit around the moon, which will be roughly an 11-day orbit. So it'll go all the way up like 40,000 miles away from the moon. So, you know, that's far. You know, our geosynchronous satellites, the Asians, from weather and all, are at 23,000 miles from the Earth. Well, this is going to be twice that distance, you know, except from the moon. So, you know, over 40,000 miles. And then it's going to come in close. I think it comes in around 1 or 2,000 miles off the surface of the moon. And that'll be the permanent location for this particular gateway space station. So, I mean, you know, then what will happen is flights from Earth will eventually dock with that space station. You know, they'll be using the Orion spacecraft and the Space Launch System to launch from the moon, to the moon from Earth. They'll dock with the Gateway space station. From there, they'll, you know, get out, hang out for a while. Maybe there'll be a two-person crew on a space station to greet them. And then, you know, after a couple of days, they'll climb into the Human Landing System, the HLS, which will be one of two vehicles. One is supposed to be, again, a SpaceX vehicle, a Starship, that will take them down to the moon and then do their thing down there for a couple of days, a week or whatever it is, and then return to Gateway. Or they'll be able to get into a different spacecraft built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin has a completely different looking vehicle, and that will also be attached permanently to the Gateway space station. So, you know, you could get into that one and take that down to the moon, and that'll be a human landing system as well. Go down, walk around on the moon, pick up the rocks, and then back to the space station. How will those two vehicles, the Starship that keeps going up and down and the Blue Moon that keeps going up and down, one for SpaceX, one for Blue Origin, have to be refueled? And that's what NASA will also be doing. They'll have cargo vehicles coming out to Gateway on a regular basis to refuel these vehicles. Starship, of course, is going to need more liquid oxygen and more liquid methane. Blue Origin, their Blue Moon lander, will need liquid hydrogen. That's what they're using for a fuel, and liquid oxygen. So there you go. Rough idea of what's going on in the next, you know, 4 to 10 years, I guess. Back to you, Sean.
Now, you say the Gateway Station is being built in Calverton, in the old Grumman?
No, that guy Holt, that's how he started out. He's not doing that anymore. But that guy, he started building rockets. Maybe he's still, you know, doing it, but it's called Launcher One. And he was developing engines and rockets, he was testing the engines out at Calverton. So that's what that is. Gateway space station that NASA's building is being built in Turin, Italy. So, you know, we got a company that they've done plenty of work over the last many decades with in Italy that builds these modules. They built this, a lot of modules for the space station. They always build the Cygnus cargo vehicle for NASA that goes up and down to the space station. So that's who's making it. Trying to think of their name. It escapes me. Anyway, back to you, John.
Okay, otherwise, you know, for us to go to Calverton wouldn't have been too far, and that I would have liked to have seen the space station.
Oh, I wish. I wish the Grumman days were back. You know, I mean, they had room out there. I worked out there a couple of times. You know, I used to watch the F-14 take off. You know, and that was really, really a very interesting place to work. I didn't work for Grumman, by the way. We worked for outside contractors that came in to do work on their systems. Let me just see if anybody else has comments. I should leave some room. And Charlie, when I unkey, you should leave a little pause before you key up. It's not like HF, you know? You're supposed to wait for the courtesy tone on this repeater. What's going to happen is, you know, I go on and on too long. And, you know, the repeater has X amount of time, what is it, 3-4 minutes, whatever it is. And then if you key up right away, what will happen is that repeater will eventually time out. And I believe, yeah, you go into, you're transmitting into Selden, so, yeah, that's what would happen. Anyway, anybody else have a comment before I go on? This is WS2X.
Paul?
Yeah, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I looked up Anna Menon was the medical officer. As far as I can tell, her credentials are she has a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics and Spanish and a Master of Science in Biomedical Engineering. So a part-time orderly probably has better skills as far as medicine is concerned.
Really? Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not good. You know, NASA always has a doctor on board, medical officer. But if you listen to their credentials, you know, this guy's going up, that guy's going up, and Dr. So-and-so is going up on a flight, you know. I remember Dr. Thaggett was, he went up to the Mir spacecraft in the 90s, and nice to have a doctor up there. I mean, a real one.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, she doesn't even have a doctorate in biomedical engineering. Basically, she's just a SpaceX engineer. They needed probably 4 people, and there's something about biomedical in her degree. So they said, okay, great, you're the doctor. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, I took biology when I was in high school. And thank God for the girl next to me. I don't think I'd ever get out of that class for it.
I don't know. I liked it. The only thing I didn't like about biology was dissection. Some people had great hands for dissection. I never did.
Nah, that wasn't for me. Earth science part was great, but biology was tough. And I knew early on I was not going to have anything to do with medical. Meanwhile, I had a mother who was really into this, and she had worked for a doctor for 30 years, I guess. Worked for a dermatologist. So, no, not me. I didn't mind taking things apart, putting things together, but, you know, they weren't made of things that were made. They weren't people. Interesting. Was the way everybody, you know, chooses their occupations when they're younger. You never know. But I think you need both. But, you know, you don't need people imitating other occupations. You know, I always said, you know, you could take somebody and put a fireman's jacket on them. That doesn't make them a fireman. Anyway, I just have a couple more topics I was going to go through real quick.
PhD.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. Back to you, WS2.
Good thought there in the end, I agree. I'll remind you of some space history, though. What was Sally Ride's job on the Challenger?
The first flight or the second flight? The first flight, the main job was actually to be the first woman to go into space. So they had all kinds of stuff attached to her, making sure she wasn't going to explode when she went up. So, you know, that's part of it. On the second flight, when they got, they did have the robotic arm. She was the main person to test out the robotic arm on the spacecraft.
I would venture to guess it was more just virtue signaling than an actual task. It was a show, like the rich guy on this flight you were talking about. A lot of it's just a show.
Oh yeah, partially. Yeah, but you know, are they taking precautions when they do the show? You know, and you know, you could never do enough to make something 100% safe, of course. But you know, if you have the option, you know, you're not gonna not do it. And he like with SpaceX putting a crew at risk, I don't know, you know. I don't, I'm glad they got back, but it seems kind of strange. I would have waited until one or two things. Either Starship was built, so you could have, you know, plenty of room for an airlock, or somehow design an airlock within the Dragon spacecraft. You know, which would have, and of course, it's a major thing, but it was a major thing to do anyway. You know, they had to disconnect the docking ring, NASA docking ring from the front of the spacecraft that normally docks are attached to the International Space Station, or it's called ITER. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter on the space station. That completely gone. So then when they open up the hatch in the front, you know, instead of having a docking ring to dock to the space station, it's open, you know. Do an EVA, you know, out of that. But, there's a lot of, you know, what you would consider stunts when they tested out the man maneuvering systems, you know, on shuttle. They would fly around in the cargo bay, completely unattached, no tether or anything. You know, risky, yeah. But they felt that, you know, if something went wrong, they'd still be there. They'd have a chance of getting back. You know, they could have always closed the cargo bay doors around them and, you know, maybe brought them back that way. You know, John Glenn, second flight, he went up. I mean, he... Old guy at the time, in his 70s, and you know, had a stunt, yeah, partially a stunt, but at the same time, they did want to check out how somebody, you know, that's a lot older, how he would respond. They had all his vitals and information from when he was younger. They compared the two, so. Yeah, there's a lot of things that seem like they could be stunts. But I think when you're doing something, yeah, to roll the dice the way SpaceX is doing it, I worry about something going wrong with manned space program on his end. Something goes wrong, it could set the manned space program back in this country for years, you know. I mean, that's really what happened when we lost guys in the fire. 1967, lost three astronauts, Grissom, Chappie, and White. Way back. I mean, they still were accelerating. They called it gold fever to get to the moon. Same thing happened with Challenger. And that set us back 2 years. And, of course,
Columbia. When that burnt up, coming back through the atmosphere, another couple of years out the window. Anyway, looking at the time, one thing I was going to talk about was Starline. I'm glad that got back without a crew. Okay. And now that crew is on the space station now for until February. Turned into an 8-month trip for them. And they'll be returning on Dragon, which is good. It is a reliable, so far a very reliable spacecraft, which is great to see. And Starship itself, still, as far as I'm concerned, still under development. And both Boeing and NASA at this time has no plans of dropping that program. So what are they going to do? Another test flight? We shall see. They've done 3 so far, and it's still not commissioned yet. Any comments?
Question in one YDY.
Okay, YDY, go ahead.
Yeah, at one point there was another craft, I believe it was called Dream Chaser by Sierra Nevada, and I think that they're still developing it for unmanned use, but is there any talk about perhaps reconsidering that as a manned craft?
Yeah, the company has never dropped that idea, never. And yeah, Sierra Nevada. I still call it that recently, or maybe a year or so ago, they changed the name to Space, which I wish they wouldn't change their names. I don't know, I'm trying to remember what they were originally called. But, you know, that's the only thing that changed within that company is the name. They still have plans of building a Dream Chaser with a crew. Dream Chaser was scheduled to go up sometime this year. I think it might be delayed until early next year. And that's going to launch on a Vulcan rocket. Cargo vehicle is going to be able to carry more cargo than what's been going up lately, 12,000 pounds worth of stuff compared to Soyuz cargo vehicle is, what, 5,000-6,000 pounds. Dragon, I think, is 8,000 pounds they could bring up. And the same for the Cygnus cargo vehicle. But yeah, you're right. They never dropped that idea. In fact, that was the original plan. You see, early testing of that vehicle, you know, it came down. They drop it from a helicopter, and it would come down and land on a runway. And you know, it had glass on it. You know, I mean, this is going to be just for people. And then what happened was NASA gave them a contract for at least minimum of 6 cargo flights to the space station. So they've been building it for that reason. But they never gave up the idea. In fact, the plans are still, they're actually working on it, designing it and all to eventually have a crew. But that's on their own. At some point, if NASA decides to go ahead with them, and I think they should. It looks like a real good vehicle. That would be great. Then they would have another way to go, you know, up and down, not only to space stations, but all these other future space stations that are being built. Back to you, WS1.
I don't think there's anything more to add, but thanks for telling me what was going on. Anyone mind you went clear?
Yeah, that's sad. The latest I've heard, probably, oh, I don't know, 3 months ago, I remember reading about it and wondering if they were still going ahead with that. And I haven't heard anything bad, so they plan on using this on a regular basis, not only for the space station, but for future space stations that are being built, like by the European Space Agency is building one. You know, you're going to need vehicles to bring people and cargo back and forth. Okay, for now, anyway, I'm going to close this portion of the net, unless somebody else has any last minute comments. We'll be passing it over.